Hi, I'm Roy Spencer of PermaSeal. For over 45 years, we've helped over 500,000 homeowners make their homes drier, healthier, and more valuable. Our warranties are transferable and estimates are free. Call 800-421-SEAL or visit permaseal.net.
Chicago Cubs, a curated history of the North Siders. And I thought, perfect for Father's Day. What did I just say? Because that would assume women are not Chicago Cub fans, and that is a an absolute incorrect assumption. Bruce Miles, co-author of the book with Jesse Rogers. Bruce, welcome to WGN.
Thank you very much. It's always good to talk Cubs baseball on WGN. Something seems very fitting about that, so I'm happy to be here today.
Absolutely true, and maybe we will have time to talk. I want to start, you mentioned this a couple of times in the book, so I'm just going to come out and ask you. Did Babe Ruth really call his shot in the 1932 World Series game at Wrigley Field? You say probably not.
Yeah, I say probably not because it wasn't in the ethos of the game that way, even though Babe was a showman to kind of show up the other team. And the Cubs pitcher at the time, Charlie Root, said that if Root had done that, he'd have knocked him on his backside. So I think he pointed out to say there's strike one and there's strike two, Babe, and next thing you know, the ball's going out. So it really makes for a good piece of folklore, which is okay. You know, baseball's all about that.
So the research you did indicated, because I thought, and, you know, I'm wrong on a daily basis. I'm wrong on an hourly basis. I'm wrong on a minute-to-minute basis, but I really thought I saw a video at some point in time of Babe Ruth going to the batter's box and then lifting his right arm, pointing to right field. Did I not see that video clip?
Yeah, there was a video of that. I don't know how definitive it is. But most people say that Babe was pointing at the pitcher saying, okay, you got one strike on me. Then it was strike two, and Babe pointed back at him and said, okay, that's two strikes. So, and then, of course, Babe embellished it. So,
I hope you're still there, because whatever reception we've got is disintegrating, as did that home run on that day, or my knowledge, because this I had no – that's what makes this book so good. I learned so much. I mentioned this in promoting – the fact that I would be talking to you. I mentioned, okay, I'm going to bring up Gabby Hartnett. That's a name a lot of Cub fans don't remember. I know the name as much as anything else. So I live near Wrigley Field, and sometimes I run by, if you call what I do running, by Wrigley Field, and I see the bricks out there, right? And one is named for, I mean, they're all named for Chicago Cubs stars. And, of course, I remember the current, I know the current, but Gabby Hartnett is one of them. And way before my time, he was a catcher, and already I have several texts here about Gabby Hartnett. One, and you write about this too, Gabby had a bowling alley in Lincolnwood on Lincoln Avenue, apparently. It later became Cy's Bowling Alley. That I did not know. Eventually, it was torn down. Several people I went to high school, writes our listener, several people I know that went to high school bowled there. I even ran into Mr. Hartnett eating there. So let's talk about Gabby Hartnett.
Okay, Gabby was probably the best catcher in Cubs history, all respect to Wilson Contreras. He hit one of the biggest home runs in Major League history that nobody knows about, or we've all forgotten about, the homer in the Gloman in 1938 in September as darkness was descending, no lights at Wrigley Field, and it didn't win them the 38 pennant, but it helped them get there. And I wanted to go into that, find out what kind of a guy Gabby was, and really kind of resurrect that home run. And I had just a wonderful visit with his granddaughter a couple of years ago when I was writing the book and interviewed her about that. And she gave me a lot of insights into what kind of a guy he was. On a rainy day, on an off day, still doing a clinic with kids when other players might have blown it off. But he hit one of the biggest home runs. You talk about Carlton Fisk and Bill Mazeroski and Joe Carter and all these home runs. Gabby's was just as important, but there was no radio footage, or we have no radio play-by-play preserved. There was no TV. There was no film. And I just wanted to kind of give that its proper due.
Mm-hmm. No, you sure did. And again, I learned a lot, and what you're referring to is there was some sort of pickup game with kids, I guess, and it was raining, and the other professional ball players, I don't want anything to do with that. It's pouring outside. But Gabby Hartnett participated in that and played with the kids.
Yeah, he was, I think, with a scheduled off day for the Cubs, and there was kind of an informal thing. Hey, there's a clinic or there's something or other going on with kids, and it was raining, and the kids and the kids' parents didn't expect anybody to show up, but Gabby showed up, and his granddaughter, when I talked with her about that, she was quite proud that her grandfather would do such a thing, and I've seen her at the ballpark wearing a Hartnett number 9 jersey. And I used to go around and chase jerseys, so that was always a fun one for me. So kind of come full circle there.
Do you think that his jersey ought and his name ought to be retired before no one at all remembers who he was?
No, you know what? Jersey numbers weren't that big, and he wore several different numbers, according to my historian, Ed Hardig, who helped me out with the book. So, I mean, it would be a nice gesture. He's in the Cubs Hall of Fame, and I just... it's one of those that could go either way, but the jerseys didn't, the numbers didn't seem to be such a big deal back then.
I thought he wore number 9, which was Hundley's number, right?
Hundley and, you know, many, many others over the years. So, I mean, it would be kind of cool. I wouldn't be opposed to that.
Okay. Sammy Sosa, this interesting era, which many of us remember, which was so exciting until we found out what we found out. And then Sammy became kind of a controversial figure. I think that's an understatement. Some question as to whether he'll ever be in the Hall of Fame. And then the Chicago Cubs looked the other way. And now they've kind of made up. And you tell this whole story up to the point when they made up because your book was published. So can you talk about that a bit?
Yeah, what I wanted to do with Sammy, since I covered him from 1998 until 2004 upon his messy exit, I wanted to find out what his legacy was. Part of the chapter is a memoir for me because I did cover it and deal with him every day. And others, I just wanted to talk to people, his managers, other people around the team about what his legacy is and what it should be. And the answer is it's complicated. The whole steroid thing, I think the tiff with the Cubs and then not letting Sammy back was silly, but I wrote in the book, and it turned out to be a little bit prescient, not giving myself any credit, but I said, if Sammy gets into the Cubs Hall of Fame, I said, they have to let him back. It would be bad form on Ricketts' part not to let a Cubs Hall of Famer back. So lo and behold, he gets voted into the Cubs Hall of Fame last year. And he was back at the convention and even did some work in spring training, and he'll be there in September during the Hall of Fame induction. But his legacy is so deep and so complicated, and it involves the White Sox, too, because when the White Sox obtained him from Texas in 1989, it tore apart the White Sox organization. Manager Jeff Torborg was furious that they traded the popular Harold Baines for this unknown kid Sosa, and veterans like Carlton Fisk and Greg Walker wanted nothing to do with Sosa. So it's just with stuff you talk about learning. I learned a lot of stuff.
Hmm. Now, when you covered the Cubs, you didn't write about this in the book, but I'm going to ask. When you covered the Cubs, did you have any idea that players, it wasn't only Sosa, allegedly, was abusing substances to enhance performance? Did you have any idea that was going on?
We had suspicions. And when I started in 98, the whole steroid thing was just beginning. So we found out that Mark McGuire, through a reporter who saw a bottle of androstenedione in his locker, which is a performance enhancer. So at that time, we were beginning to learn about what these things were. But unless you caught somebody getting their behind injected or taking some pill, you didn't know, and you couldn't follow a guy to his home or to his doctor or whoever was doing whatever they were doing, if they were doing it. So at that time, 98, all of this was just beginning to come to the forefront.
Is it pretty clear that Sosa was, because he's kind of since recently admitted that there was something going on with substance abuse, but he really hasn't, I guess, understandably, from his perspective, talked about it. So do we even today know exactly how performance enhancing it was and if it really did impact his performance on the field, particularly his batting record?
Yeah, that's a great question. I have to believe that he was. I can't say for sure, but when you look at how he grew in size, not to mention his stature of being larger than life in a figurative sense. But I have to believe that he did. Now, whether it helps or not, you have to have the hand-eye coordination to hit a baseball. On the other hand, though, it helps with recovery. And when you play 162 games, and Sammy, to his credit, wanted to play every single day, and he did play, you know, 160, 161, and 162, and he was a tireless worker. So if anything, the steroids probably helped him recover if he was taking them once again and, you know, be ready to play every day.
Okay, much more to talk about. The book is Chicago Cubs, A Curated History of the Northsiders. We'll talk about night games and the stories you didn't know. And I had no clue at all. We'll talk about that and what Bruce Miles, the co-author of the book, thinks about today's Chicago Cubs when we come back on WGN. Hopefully you're not missing the Chicago Cubs. What a great season they're having. We'll talk about that. But first, is it because of the night games? I had no idea of this. Bruce Miles, co-author of Chicago Cubs, A Curated History of the Northsiders, that the Cubs, first going back to 1942, were about to install lights in Wrigley Field. No controversy, no problem. But then, after December 7th, 1941, the attack by Japan against the U.S. at Pearl Harbor, it prompted entry into World War II, and Cubs owner P.K. Wrigley, said, you know what, I'd rather donate the materials to the, instead of for lights, we'll use it for the government, for the war effort. And then decades went before it was all brought up again. I had no idea about that.
Yeah, I mean, night games at Wrigley Field, a topic of conversation for many, many years, and nobody really thought anything of it after that. Night games were kind of a new thing beginning in the 30s, and the course of history probably would be different if they had installed the lights after the 41 season. But, you know, P.K. Wrigley decided, you know, I don't need these, and then he kind of lost interest in the whole night game thing. He pretty much lost interest in running the Cubs day-to-day. He was up at his mansion in Lake Geneva most of the time. So if the Cubs, if anything, under P.K. Wrigley, suffered from benign neglect is probably the best way to put it. But he just wasn't that interested in night games until, well, after his passing, the networks took over and said, if you're going to be in the postseason, you better have lights for night games.
And that whole story is almost too much to tell in detail here, because you go into great detail about the network's perspective, the commissioner of baseball's perspective, the ownership's perspective of the Chicago Cubs. But then there's the neighborhood. There were local politicians, including, what is it, the 44th ward, maybe, that ward? The alderman at the time. So all of that played in, and there was actually a city council. It wasn't a resolution. It was a what's the word that I'm looking for? Not a law. That's not quite the word. But there was a city. The city council said you cannot have lights at Wrigley Field, right?
Well, that's correct. And the basis of the chapter is that, and it's something that was stuck in my craw for 40 years. There was a myth that developed that the Cubs lost home field advantage in the 1984 series against the Padres, National League Championship Series, because they didn't have lights. Well, that is not true. And for some reason, that became a myth over time. And it was spread by people like Dallas Green and Rick Sutcliffe, who were with the Cubs and maybe trying to excuse them losing three straight games in San Diego after they went up 2-0. But there was this myth that developed that they'd lost home field advantage because they didn't have lights. Well, no, that's not true. The series played out as it was supposed to play. I did all the research, and I lived through it. And they would have lost home field in the World Series against the Tigers had they made it. So that's the real story. But, I mean, you get involved in all these things. Ordinance, I think, was the word you're looking for.
Yes.
City council, yep. Ordinance about lights. But it was just a big bone of contention in this whole myth developed. Well, they got the lights in 1988, and everybody seems to have lived happily ever after. But we got to pick and choose subjects, and that whole myth thing was stuck in my craw for a long, long time, and I wanted to set it straight.
All right, but there are many people who say, listen, the Cubs would have gone farther, and sometimes way further, if they had lights and didn't have to play all these day games. Is there any truth to that, do you think?
Yeah, I think so. And one chapter in the book is about the 1969 Cubs.
Who the had what?
I
heard of those, yes.
Yeah, in August of 69, they're about 9 games up. Ken Holtzman pitched a no-hitter, and we were on our way. I think what happened between day games wearing them out and manager Leo Durocher overusing a lot of his players, including the aforementioned Randy Hundley, the Cubs just collapsed down the stretch. Part of it was from fatigue. Part of it was the Mets got hotter than heck, and their manager, Gil Hodges, used his entire roster where Leo didn't trust anybody but his starter. So, but I think, you know, getting back to the lights question, I think, yes, it played a role in the 69 team collapsing.
All right, we have about a minute left. I need your expert opinion on this year's Chicago Cubs. How far are they going to go?
I think depending on what they do at the trade deadline at the end of July or thereabouts, they should win their division. I thought before the season they should win their division handily, and if they don't, changes should be made at the top there. They need a starting pitcher. You know, you have Justin Steele out for the year with the elbow. Imanaga is still on the injured list with the hamstring. They've done remarkably well despite that, and they did remarkably well with a tough schedule beginning in Japan and playing a lot of good teams. But I think they will win their division. They should win it handily. And I think if with the right moves at the deadline, I think they could be poised for a long run.
All right. Well, when they get into the playoffs and are in the World Series, maybe we'll talk to you again.
Yeah, that would be great. Always good to have a World Series in Chicago. I've only seen 2 of them.
We don't have them every year, that's for sure. The name of the book again, Chicago Cubs, A Curated History of the Northsiders. Bruce Miles, co-author with Jesse Rogers. Thank you so very much for joining us.
I really enjoyed it. Thank you. Let's do it again sometime.
You bet. Go Cubbies.